WPFW is a proud media partner with Bethesda Theater.
Welcome to The Collision.
The Collision, where sports and politics smash. Thursdays at 10 a.m. and on iTunes and Google Play. WPFW, Washington, D.C.
I'm Kamaya.
I'm Amira.
I'm Kaya.
I'm Kamaya.
And you're listening to WPFW Washington.
Another man done gone. Another man done gone from the county farm. Another man done gone.
Huh? I don't know. What? I'm just going across the street.
Shut your mouth.
Oh, no.
What'd I do?
Turn around, turn around. Put your hands behind your back. Let's go.
The jury of your peers having found you guilty, 10 years.
What?
Come on. Get that.
I was in jail too, man. It's cold-blooded in the jail. You go down there looking for justice. That's what you find. Just us.
Welcome to another edition of Crossroads Today. Now here's your host, Roach Brown.
Welcome to Crossroads. This is our second hour. For the first Tuesday of each month, we normally come to you live for a two-hour show from the world-famous Ben's Chili Bowl, but we're not at Ben's Chili Bowl this morning. We'll be back next month. We want to thank you for tuning in to Crossroads here on WPFW 89.3 FM, your station for jazz and justice. As we said, we want to send out a shout out to our good friend and buddy who's in the hospital, Al Malik Farrakhan of Ceasefire Don't Smoke, the brothers and sisters. He's been in the hospital a few days, and we understand he's on the mend. Hopefully we'll see him out real soon. So please keep him in your prayers because we need him. There's nobody been doing what he's been doing. He touched and affected and improved the status of a lot of lives in this city and across this country. So Al Malik, our prayers grow with you. Hope you get better soon, buddy. And Merry Christmas to you, you turkey. We need to see you out here. Now we go back to what we call the grapevine. Information that you can use. The grapevine.
Oh, I heard through the grapevine. Don't you know that I heard through the grapevine? Oh, I'm just about to lose my mind. Honey, honey, well.
They killed their abusive partners. Now this sentence could be reconsidered. Oklahoma could reexamine how it punishes people whose crimes came after years of domestic abuse. This week, Oklahoma came closer to passing a law allowing judges to reduce criminal sentences for some domestic violence survivors whose abuse was a substantial contributing factor to their crime. The bill, pushed by several Republican legislators, had broad bipartisan support in the state, with the nation's highest rate of domestic violence and the third highest rate of women in prison. The state Senate had to overcome a veto from the governor, and the House would need to do the same, in order for the bill to become law. The Oklahoma measure, which would allow incarcerated people to apply for a retroactive resentencing, comes after years of advocacy and growing attention to many survivors who are locked up for crimes that stem from their experience of abuse. One study of women in Oklahoma state prisons found that 66% of experienced intimate partner violence in the years before they were incarcerated. In a separate case, a lady was convicted of killing her partner, who was also the father of her two children. After years of physical, sexual, and psychological abuse, she was sentenced in New York's Justice Act, but her trial judge refused to lessen her time, sending her to prison for 19 years. A state appellate court later overturned the conviction. California police are using a controversial tactic after someone dies in their custody. When police kill someone, they have to notify the family. Some officers are using that moment for something else. Bruce Patton is a well-known name in law enforcement, especially across California. He co-founded a company called Lexipol that contracts with more than 95% of police departments in the state and offers its clients training and ready-made policies. In one of past training webinars posted online, He offers a piece of advice that police and experts have called inhumane. It's aimed at protecting officers and their departments from lawsuits. The reporter stated, looking into this advice when it was with the investigating reporting program at University of Berkeley, California, he found that officers have been using this tactic across California, and the information families disclosed before they knew their relatives was killed affected their lawsuits later. After police kill someone, they are supposed to notify the family. But he advises officers to use that interaction as an opportunity instead of delivering the news of the death immediately. He suggests first asking about the person who was killed to get as much information and background and history on the victim. That in turn impacts what happens when and if they decide to take the case to court. And that's been classified as an inhuman practice. Stop blending sentences, push to punish Tennessee children as both juveniles and adults. The Sentencing Project agrees that Tennessee should be serious about safety, but passing blended sentencing legislation is a distraction, a poor, short, and long-term investment. Tennessee's youth justice crisis has earned national media attention, but those problems aren't about the youth. The system is designed to serve. They are about the adults who failed them. The state needs to address the problem in its own facilities. Instead, some in the legislation are trying to fill those same facilities with young people. The latest distraction will overhaul Tennessee's youth justice system by introducing an outdated and convoluted sentencing option called blended sentencing. Under blended sentencing legislation, children processed through juvenile court and held in detention centers will be further punished if they aren't rehabilitated or successful by the time they're 19. The proposal are based on the lie that youth offending is up. That's not true. Youth arrests in Tennessee and Memphis are actually on the decline, according to the Tennessee Bureau of Investigation. Prison attack dogs have attacked hundreds of incarcerated people and staff. Prison guards have used dogs to attack nearly 300 people in state custody and more than a dozen prison employees over the past 6 years, leaving many permanently disabled. Insider used public health records and court documents, medical records, and interviews with dozens of bite victims to document at least 295 incidents in which attack-trained dogs bit and mauled incarcerated people during the six-year period. During that period, handlers used attack-trained dogs against people incarcerated in at least 23 prisons in 8 states and found with 271 of the 295 documented attacks, Virginia is by far the leading user of prison attack dogs. In that state, 6 high-security prisons. Insider found that attack-trained dogs are deployed against incarcerated people as a routine use of force, and a lot of times the men are shackled and still in their cells. And that's been what we call the grapevine, information that you can use. Thank you. Now we get to the second hour of our first Tuesday morning show. This hour, and the topic is cannabis and returning citizens. And we have someone who's been on our guest many times in the past, Miss Linda Mercado Green, owner of Anacostia Organics, a cannabis dispensary in Southeast Washington. Good morning, Linda and Green.
Merry Christmas.
Oh, you beat me to it, Linda. I couldn't get it to you. Oh,
as
you
long
got
as
me.
I've known you, you don't think that I wouldn't do that, huh? I'm so happy to be back on the show. And before, I just want to say, Al-Malik Farrakhan, I love you with all my heart. You probably don't know, I've been calling him hubby for years. He calls me wifey. We've been together for many, many years. He's a dear, dear friend, and my prayers. He's already beat one thing, you know, when he got up and stood up out of that wheelchair and hasn't sat back in it. So I love him with all my heart. So thank you for not, sending him those wishes.
Right. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you, Linda, because he's quite a fella. Everybody in his town, if you've been in D.C. for a while, you know who Al Malik Farrakhan is and what he's been doing in our community. So please get well soon, man. We miss you.
Yes. Yes, we do.
And the topic for this show is this hour is cannabis and return to citizen. But before we get to the return to citizen part, Linda, you've been over in Anacostia for how long running Anacostia Organics cannabis dispensary? How did you get started to get into cannabis, and how long have you been over in Anacostia?
It was a fluke how I got started in it. As you know, my background is public relations, and I still have a PR firm, public relations, public affairs. And I've been involved in a lot in, let's see, is this better?
Yes.
Okay, sorry. I've been, involved in D.C. Legislative government and on the national and international side as well. But sat dinner with some friends one night and somebody mentioned that D.C. had legalized cannabis. This is back in 2014, I think, when we were having dinner. And I didn't know about it. I didn't know medical cannabis was actually legal in D.C., and started looking at it. And I think it was about 2016 that we decided that we would look into it further and go for a license. So my co-founders are Yolanda Carraway and Sherry Blunt. And so the three of us started digging deep into the laws of DC. We actually FOIA'd the records to see who owned the dispensaries, where they were from, where this dispensaries and the cultivators were, actually located in the city. And the initial goal was to be the first Black ownership of a license of a cultivator in the women, female-owned cultivators in the city. And after 3 years of having a broker and not being able to find a warehouse, D.C. is not an industrial town. And we are landlocked and height restricted. So, we could not find a warehouse available, because if you're going to grow, you have to be serious about it. It's because it's a very expensive process. So we were looking for anything over 5,000 feet, but more like 10,000, 15,000 square footage. But it didn't exist. So, after 3 years of that, and in the meantime, I've been traveling the country and meeting the multi-state operators and seeing how the business ran, I decided to go for a license. And so we had to appeal to the mayor and the council. And actually, we drew a draft legislation and took it to them with the data that we had found that D.C. had awarded the majority of the cultivation licenses and the dispensary licenses to non-Washingtonians. There was only one brother that got a cultivation license. There was only one sister that had a dispensary license. And so there were none east of the river. We found that 170,000 residents in Ward 7 and 8 did not have access to a medical cannabis dispensary. They were assigned by the Department of Health of which ones they would go to. And the Department of Health at that time was assigning almost everyone to Tacoma Wellness on Blair Avenue, Blair and Easton up there.
Yeah.
In Ward 4, which means that they would have to get rideshare, buses, whatever to get there. Now, we're talking about the most underserved population as we that are having to go through all of this. I started looking for a dispensary, decided we'll go for a dispensary. So I knew I wanted to be east of the river based on that data. And by the way, I got that passed unanimously by the city council, and the mayor signed it immediately. But in order to make sure that I had a heads up, because the process is open to anybody. So anybody in the country could have applied. I get all of my companies certified as a business enterprise since I'm a DC resident, and I hire DC employees and everything. So I was the first cannabis company in the in Washington D.C. To be DSLB CBE certified, and so they awarded extra points for that, and that's how I got over. in addition to the fact I FOIA'd the records to see who was the most winning attorney to do applications, and we found the guy in New York and hired him to do our application. It's a totally different process now than when we started. The application was 862 pages. It cost $160,000 for the attorney to write it.
Wow.
So because doing that time,
I wrote that for a lot less.
But during that time, you had to have so many specifics.
I'm a jailhouse lawyer. I'd have wrote that.
It was crazy. It was absolutely crazy because you had to have all of your IT serial numbers, everything. So you had to make the investment in the business, not even knowing if you were going to get the license.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so, you know, but one of the problems we had was that because we are still federally legal, no one wanted to lease to us because the landlords would be leasing to a federally illegal business and their property could be taken by them. There was a building that I passed every day. I live in a historic Anacostia now for 25 years. And it just stood out. And so I said, that building has been empty for a long, long time. So we FOIA'd the real estate records and the tax records, found the owner, investigated that. And I contacted him and invited him to lunch and told him what I wanted to do. And he understands the benefits of cannabis. And he said, I'd be very happy to lease my building to you. Beautiful. And so, you know, things just started going in place. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And you've been in business over 10 years. You was the
No. I didn't get my license I put the application until 2017 to get the application process allowed to reopen in the city council and Department of Health. So the application process opened in 2017, like in June or July, somewhere around there. Mm-hmm. And I submitted the application in February, 2018. And then it was awarded, the license was awarded in July of 2018. And I was able to open in January 2019. So it's
A couple of months before the pandemic.
January 2019. So the pandemic hit in 2020.
Yeah. So let me chime in real quick for a moment on both, because I'm going to have to hop off and then hop back on. I just want to say hats off to Linda Mercado Green. She is the queen of any and all things cannabis and Black folk and getting our seat at the table and all that. And to hear about the studentiness with which she went about getting that license, that just speaks volumes. And I did not realize it was just a couple of years ago, because I'd seen your name so much affiliated with these issues that I thought you had been at it much longer than just 2019. I just want to say hats off to you, my sister.
And I have not.
Yeah, go on. Anyway.
It's so good to hear your voice. I hope to see you again in person soon. You know,
thank you for all of your work. And, you know, everyone's looking at your model and, you know, seeking to come behind you. I'm going to have to hop off. I'm going to try to hop off. Keep on spreading the good news.
We'll be right here when you hop back on. Let me ask you this question. One of the things that we're concerned with is that the city council passed another bill recently about the Cannabis Act. Uh-huh. And it mentioned that they're giving out 100 licenses for cannabis, and 50% of those licenses are supposed to be designated for returning citizens. And this is the first time I've heard this in the country, that a city legislative body is earmarked a particular segment of the population to apply for cannabis, since we know a lot of these guys that sold weed on the street, a lot of them went to jail, and we still got people still in jail for cannabis.
Yeah.
But the D.C. Senate Council took a step forward and said that we're going to give out 100 new licenses, and 50 of those licenses are designated for felons or people with criminal records. Have you heard that, Linda?
I have been very involved in the legislation to open up the process. Extremely Beautiful. Involved. I chair the DC Cannabis Trade Association, which is Association of Legal Licensees, we eventually folded because it was taking too much time for my business. But at the same time, I'm a school of Roach Brown and Marion Barry and all of that. So I'm the type of person that I'm open and accessible to anyone. So I told the city when they did that, I said, please send them to me so I can guide them and tell them what they're going to face and everything, because it's not as easy. Mm-hmm. I didn't have this guidance when I got in it. It is the business is over exaggerated for money and all of that, but the rules and regulations. I've been very involved in the process, but knowing the data that I had to pull, and we were Chocolate City, as you know, and we didn't get these licenses, and we didn't even know, you know, that it even existed.
So what does someone with a criminal record, an ex-felon, does if you want to apply for a cannabis license, recreational medical, or a cultivation license? What do they have to do?
So we got the process. So when I got my license, you could either be a cultivator or a dispenser. So the cultivator did the cultivation. They did the manufacturing process and lab testing. We still don't have a lab test lab testing facility in DC because the market hasn't been big enough for them to invest that type of fund. So a regulating agency is now the Alcohol Beverage Cannabis Administration, which we had a major influence on moving from Department of Health, who did not support medical cannabis. What they have done, rather, they are making that free for the lab tester that to come in, no application fee or whatever, but they have to get approval. And because everybody's stuff has to be lab tested. I mean, it's got to be.
If someone was arrested and sent to prison for selling marijuana, now they're out, can they apply for a cannabis license even though they were sentenced and convicted for that in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. In D.C. Now, what you have to know, every state has their own set of rules and regulations, and it narrows down to jurisdictions in those states can states. Set their own rules and regulations. Yeah. But if you, a family member, which would be a parent, a sibling, a child, have been arrested for a cannabis violation, you are considered, you can apply for a social equity license.
Social equity.
Yeah, it's primarily social equity. The rules and regulations are quite different. The amount of the fees are very low, but you still have to go through a process. You still have to have what they would do, you do an application, and they will, based on that application, you can get a conditional license. The conditional license gives you time to get your location, get your funds, to get the neighborhood approval, you know, those type of things set up. That gives you, I think it's like a year that the city has given you to do that. It's all on OPCA's website under medical cannabis.
What website?
ABCA.dc.gov. Okay. So that's the Alcohol Beverage Cannabis Administration. So it's A is in apple, B is in boy, C is in cannabis, A is in apple, .dc.gov. Okay. And it's very, and I can tell you that the employees there are very accessible. If you have questions on how to do this, how to do that, and they work very closely with you. So they have had this opened up last year. Mm-hmm. I think it's been a year.
Is DC the only city that you know of when returning citizens or ex-felons have been designated to recommended to apply for a cannabis license? Is this
most cities? Most cities and states are doing that now that are in cannabis. Maryland has a wonderful program, and they have they actually have a fund to set up to help the social equity applicants.
Uh-huh.
And so it's not just for returning citizens, it's for those who fall below a financial threshold as well. That type. But, you know, we have in D.C., we up until recently, we only had 7 legal licensees, but there were like 500 unlicensed storefronts operating in D.C.
And how has that affected the cannabis market? Because they gifting weed. You go in and buy a T-shirt and they give you weed. How does that impact your business?
It has impacted my business tremendously. A lot of people in D.C., we're a government town. We can't ever forget that we're a government town. So we have a lot of government workers here. A lot of people don't want their name in a system. You must, if you're a D.C. resident, you must register. Well, anybody that comes, we've changed the laws tremendously that anybody over 21 from anywhere in the world can come to D.C. and buy cannabis from a legal cannabis operator. There is a small fee. You have to have, you know, your ID, but there's a small fee associated with it just to register. So, for instance, if you're here just for a weekend, you can get a 3-day temporary card, and it's all done online and it's immediate. So you can walk into Anacostia Organics with your ID, pay your $10 up to $100 for 360 days, and shop right then and there.
Okay. One of the questions I got that's been questioned, now that cannabis medicinal and recreation has been legalized all over the country and in some cities, what happens when somebody who have got a job and they take a urinalysis and they got a medical cannabis card and the doctor prescribed them to take cannabis for their pain or treatment or whatever? How does this impact? Because you got people on parole, probation, or some sensitive jobs like bus drivers, etc. They cannot indulge in cannabis.
Well, I'm going to tell you, I'm fighting for emergency personnel like our firemen, our police officers, that type of thing, to be able to use medical cannabis when they are not working. Pittsburgh has done it, and other cities have done it. I'd rather for them to do that than to drink a gallon of Jack Daniels when they get home, because you have to think about the trauma and what they face every single day. And you know, they have to release, they have to, and you know, that's a fact. But medical cannabis definitely helps the anxieties and, you know, and those type of things. So Pittsburgh has done it. We're looking into D.C. I've been asking for that for quite a while. And hopefully that's going to come. But the laws are quickly changing throughout the United States with the acceptance of cannabis. So, you know, they're like 30s. It's somewhere between 35 and 38 states that have legalized medical cannabis. There are 20 some states that have legalized recreational cannabis. One of the other things that's killing my business is that Maryland is now totally recreational. And, you know, that's our borders. So before Maryland became recreational, we had a lot of Maryland patients because we accept medical cards from anywhere in the country that has a licensed medical program. But then at the same time, we did get the laws changed so you could still come and buy medical cannabis at one of our legal dispensaries. And so the laws are constantly changing. Now, one of the good things is that President Biden directed the DEA to change the classification to look at that. Now, they announced that they do recommend descheduling it to a Schedule 3. But at the same time, it's not going to happen overnight. There's such a long process for that. But I feel that it's going to be accelerated and it will happen before the election.
You know, you suggested something, I think previously we talked, Linda, about, I forgot what it was. Is that, wow. Well, I'm telling you, getting old is something.
We're still here, though.
Yeah. We talked about a lot of folks think that this cannabis thing is a pot of gold. There's a lot of money involved. And you shared something with me that you can't deposit your money in the bank because of the federal government hasn't made change that classification, what they did recently. But we don't know if that classification will impact on you being able to bank your funds. And a lot of folks think that the cannabis industry is a pot of gold and it's misleading, and folks need to know the intricate details in terms of it ain't all what it cracked out to be.
Well, because banks are, you know, FDIC insured, they are reluctant to take cannabis money. Now, some have jumped out there on the limb and said, I'm going to take it. They charge us an arm and leg. Now, when I first opened, there were really no banks taking it. Then a bank in New Jersey, I started taking cannabis funds. So I had to get an armored truck to take it to the Federal Reserve to be verified, and they would take it to the bank. The bank deposited it. Now, the only thing I could do with that at that time was just write checks and be able to pay my employees through direct deposit. But now other banks around the country are opening up. We have banks right in this immediate area that are taking cannabis funds. And like I said, we pay for, you know, pay dearly because they are taking a big risk.
You pay to deposit your money? You have to pay?
You have to pay, yeah. Some of these banks are charging just, you know, flat $1,500 a month, but then you got to pay this armored transport as well. Now, that is a major thing. And the Federal Reserve is working with us because they're leaving a lot of money on the table that could be going to the banks and being, you know, used for loans and, you know, other investment things. So it is opening up a lot. We have FVC Bank that opened in Virginia. But they are here in D.C. They have a branch here in D.C. and throughout our metropolitan area. They are not only accepting cannabis funds, but they also, now you have to be legally licensed to do this. You can't, you know, just take, you know, $100,000 to the bank and you don't have a license, because the paperwork and the approval process just to go to these banks is very long and is very laborious. But they are also branching out and making cannabis business loans, which is why I'm moving my money from Park Bank in New Jersey to FVC Bank here. But I want to be local. I try to do everything local anyway, so that I can get, credit line or I can actually, my employees can actually get personal loans. Most banks don't do that. If you are a legal cannabis employee, you suffer financial implications as well.
I never knew that. So you're saying if you work in a cannabis shop and you get paid for working in the shop, you can't take your money to a normal regular bank. You got to go through some hoops in order to deposit your money or spend it.
If your bank finds out. You know, most people have bank accounts before they start working, you know, in the cannabis industry. But if you go into a new bank and you put down your employer and it's a cannabis company, you have issues. So there are only a few banks that, you know, allow that. So, you know, and when, you know, you have to, I think almost all of us do direct deposit now rather than paying in cash. Then, you know, all of the withdrawals, you know, come out of that. Yeah. And everything. Yeah. So it's really been a real problem.
Okay.
This is WPFW, your station for jazz and justice. WPFW, this is Crossroads with Roche Brown and Akechi Taifa. WPFW 89.3 FM. The telephone number to call in is 202-588-0893. That's 202-588-0893. We're speaking with Linda Mikado Green, owner of Anacostia Organics, and sharing this awesome information.
And we'll take our first call. We had a folks.
May I just say something before you real quick, because this is real important. Because we are federally illegal, and this is how coming from a Schedule 1 to a Schedule 3 will help any of us in the cannabis industry. Because we're federally illegal, we have to abide by the 280E IRS tax law. So we are drug trafficketeers and money launderers in the federal government's eyes, no matter how you are licensed by your state or your jurisdiction. So we have to pay anywhere from 65 cents to 85 cents of every single dollar of revenue to IRS.
Wow.
Because DC is not a state and Congress still controls our budget. Y'all get out there and fight for statehood, please. We have to pay 280E, those of us that are licensed in DC, to DC government as well. So the misnomer about making money is not, it's just simply not there. So that's why we've been fighting for either rescheduling, descheduling, or just total legalization, which is where it should be in the United States, just total legalization.
You just said something that shook me to my core. You're saying that there's a tax rate on your profits that the government takes 65% of your profits.
Minimum 65.
Huh?
Minimum. Up to 85.
So you're working for them.
Exactly. I've been operating for almost 6 years, 5.5 years, and I've not made $1 profit.
What?
Ain't that something? Do you hear that? She's been working in.
So what's the plan? What keeps you motivated and determined?
It's a fight. And I'm determined that we're going to win this fight. And I'm one of the few people of color out here nationally with these, you know, with other people who are not, you know, don't have any melatonin to this skin. So I'm out here fighting. At my story, when I sit at those tables with the senators and with the members of Congress and tell my story,
yes,
they can see it differently than those that have generational wealth.
Yes.
You know, Linda, they've been saying this all over the country. Snoop Dogg and some more people, celebrities are getting involved in this. But you just said that they take 65% of your profits in taxes.
And taxes.
How can you exist? With the high overhead and your expenses, if the government going to take 65% of your money in profit in taxes, that's not fair.
It's not. It simply is not. So that's why we've been fighting so hard. And that's why I tell everybody, you know, I could be reached at hello@anacostiaorganics.com. If you're thinking about this, I will give you time and talk to you, because it is not what is painted up to be. Now, President Biden could legalize this, and we can operate as a normal business. So,
and it would change the tax structure, so you'd be able to keep more of your profits.
Going down to a Schedule 3 is going to change the tax structure automatically.
Okay.
Once it's approved by, you know, the it has to have an administrative hearing and all this kind of stuff. But once it's approved, it's automatically going to change the tax structure for any of us that are licensed in the United States.
Hmm. We'll take our first caller. We have a caller on the line. Question or comment, please, for Linda Mikado Green, owner of Anacostia Organics. You're on the line.
Hello?
Yes, you're on the air. Come on.
Oh, okay. Thank you for taking my call. I'd like to know what types of jobs are available in the cannabis industry in D.C.?
Okay, that's a good question. So pretty much all types of jobs, from a patient care specialist, and that's a person that's a greeter, takes your information and is knowledgeable about cannabis and guides you through the process, from security officers, IT, accountants, legal, marketing, public relations, anything that affects any other business, those businesses are needed in the cannabis industry. So what I tell people is just transfer your skills, but be knowledgeable of cannabis and its medicinal benefits. You know, you can do that online or whatever, you know, just read and everything, because it is different. And, you know, just know that while it's still federally illegal, all staff has to sign waivers that they understand that the FBI can come in any day, raid us, arrest us, and that type of thing. Those are disclaimers that have to go into your, into, you know, your employees' contracts.
You said if somebody working for you and they have to sign a disclaimer knowing that this, since it hasn't been recognized by the federal government or the DEA, they can come in and arrest you in a legal cannabis establishment for selling. Yeah.
I'm legal in my state. I'm not federally legal.
Huh.
So they have to know that, you know, up front. And that has happened so rarely. You know, it typically happens in unlicensed businesses, but very, very rarely in a licensed business has that happened, unless they're suspect that the product that the licensed business is selling is not from a licensed cultivator or manufacturer.
I have a question. There are some businesses that sell cannabis and they ask for a donation. What's the difference between that and your business?
A big difference, huge difference. Number one, they're not licensed. Number two, it's called the I-71 market, where, which has been misinterpreted. That was passed through the council. Initiative 71 was in D.C. You can grow at home. You can share your cannabis at home, but you cannot sell it for any monetary value. And it's up to, I think it's 4 or 6 plants per adult. And that's, you know, that is in the law. So it's been taken to storefronts, and cannabis is being gifted for sale of a t-shirt or something. Now, I work very closely with the unlicensed market. And as far as working together to create a good legal market for all of us. And they don't want to sell t-shirts. They want to sell cannabis. But this is the only way that they can get around it. But the thing is that in any state that you are licensed in, you must buy your product from a licensed cultivator, manufacturer in that state. If you do not buy from that, that is illegal.
If you just wanted to set up a cultivation shop, how difficult is that, just sitting at this cultivation shop where you can grow a cannabis and sell it to dispensaries?
So one of the things that we are working with zoning now, because we are not industrial and we don't have a lot of space, we only have a few, four or five operating cultivators. And now the licensing process has opened up for all these hundreds of dispensaries. There's not going to be any product. You cannot ship product into D.C. or any state. You cannot cross state lines. It's federally illegal. So we're working with zoning to change the zoning laws. We have all these empty office buildings. We have, you know, we have all these places where they can grow legally that are just sitting there. That, as well as the closeness to a school, you know, all that type of stuff. So that is actively in process now to lessen the restrictions, to make it easier so that we can get some homegrown or, you know, small vendors in the space, because they have good stuff, you know, most of the time. So,
you know, if someone has a cannabis license and they go across the state line, they buy cannabis from you in D.C., can you travel to Maryland with the cannabis on you? Is that legal?
It's not legal. It's not legal. But everybody, I mean, a lot of people do it. You know, it's happening everywhere across the country, but it's not legal to cross state lines. Which means airplanes, trains, boats, everything, you know, it's not legal to cross state lines.
And even though you may have a cannabis card, a medicinal card, you still are not allowed to travel across state lines with your cannabis on you.
You're not supposed to, but I would say it's better to have the medical cannabis card on you to show that you are a medical patient, because then you got something to fight with, you know, rather than not having a card.
We have another call on.
Oh, I had another part to my question.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Come on, young lady.
Yes, and the second part was, what is the process to apply for the jobs that are available? I mean, where do you go to submit your resume or whatever you may have?
Great question. Because we are all individually owned businesses, you could just go to the website of the one that you are interested in. Maryland is steadily opening, so they still have jobs available. DC's market sort of closed because we're still going through this legislation process. But the turnover in our industry is astronomical. So I would say that you send your resume to, you know, some of the cultivators. They're always hiring as well because, you know, the cultivators in Maryland and Virginia, I mean, Maryland, D.C., or the retailers like, you know, like my shop and that type of thing, and inquire.
Okay.
You know, there's a lot of jobs. And one of the things that impressed me when I came over to your shop, Linda, the knowledge of the staff. They were calling names on weed. I ain't had no idea. Cannabis had 1,000 different names. You know what I mean? Depending on the strand, that kind of stuff. What
we
kind of training?
Extensive training.
How long is the training? Because I know they were calling names off. I had no idea what they were talking about.
And you have to keep in mind that these names change all the time because they're clones from different ones that they, you know, how, that's how the names of these plants and these medications come about. So we do an online training. I have a medical physician that comes in and trains when she's available to talk about the medical benefits. But also I do a lot of work with a lot of seniors because I'm a senior too. 72.
I didn't know that, Linda.
Yeah, and I'm trying to get in senior homes to do educational classes with them about the benefits of cannabis. But you need to know, you know, what medications they are on, and you know, anybody with any heart problems. And I would say anybody of a certain age certainly does not need to be taking any cannabis product, whether they're smoking it, using a tincture or an edible, anything with high THC, because we all take in medications at some point and stage in our lives, particularly this stage, and that could directly have a bad effect. But there are so many books out there that you could just do online. There are courses you can take online for cannabis, but we do ours in house. And I encourage my staff to take online courses as well.
Okay. So what about youth? Youth are not supposed to be, what age are you supposed to be in order to work and or try to buy some recreational cannabis?
21, typically 21, but we do have pediatric patients. They have to, you know, obviously they have to have a doctor's recommendation, and they have to, the guardian has to, get the medication for them. But we do have pediatric patients, and anybody under the age of 18 must have a guardian. 18 with a card, the guardian must come with them.
Yeah.
So personally, Linda, have you seen the benefits of people taking cannabis?
Oh, Lord, yes.
Yeah, what benefits are there?
Yes. It depends upon what you're taking it for. Anxiety. You take, you can take an edible or tincture, you know, for anxiety, or smoke some cannabis for anxiety, and it immediately decreases your anxiety. Sleeping. When we get a certain age, we can't sleep. And we're going to the bathroom all night, right? Let's make it real. So I normally take a lozenger at night, and I sleep peacefully. I'm very aware of my surroundings, but it also subsides the need to go to a bathroom, so you wake up refreshed. You know, there's just so many benefits. We have a lot of cancer patients. We have a lot of stage 4 cancer patients. We have patients that, have any type of illness you go to a doctor for. So that's why the staff has to be trained.
Okay.
Wow. And it's trial and error. It's trial and error. What works for me may not work for you. Each of us has a different endocannabinoid system. So it is totally, totally individual, and you may have to try a few things before something works.
You know, you shared some enlightening information and killed a couple of myths or misconceptions that we had.
Rush, think about it. What were the root doctors doing?
The same thing.
This is a natural plant.
Yes.
Right. And you know, they didn't have pharmaceuticals and all of that.
Yeah.
And you know, and that's when it just started getting a bad name, a bad rap, and you know, and because a lot of people do enhance it with other illegal drugs. So
yes.
Yeah.
We got a few minutes left. What would you say, Linda, to folks who are listening who maybe, like you said, they passed a law that allowed 50% of these new 100 licenses to go to people with criminal records. And even though you might have had a marijuana conviction, that does not preclude or prevent you from applying. So what would you say to somebody who want to get involved? Because you said something earlier that you've been in business over 5 years and you haven't made a profit yet.
No.
I mean, why are you still in there? Why are you still doing it?
Oh, I'm not a quitter. You know that.
Okay.
You know that. But at the same time, my investment is so massive in the millions that I can't walk away and I can't file bankruptcy because I'm federally legal, right? But I'm going to tell you what keeps me going every day, to see the benefits and how it's improving people's lives. That keeps me going, as well as I am training from my community. My staff comes from my community.
Mm-hmm.
I'm training them for new careers and new opportunities. Okay. So, you know, you get to a point, and I'm so proud that my daughter, we are one of the only two mother-daughter cannabis owner dispensaries in the United States. They are like 3 to 5. Hope Wiseman and her mother at Marion, Maine, but there are only a few. But my daughter is, I'm trying to create a legacy business.
Yeah.
We don't do that as Black people.
No.
We don't create legacies. We go in, we, you know, do what we have to do, sell it and whatever. I'm trying to be like other people, like the Asians, the Jews, you know, whatever. Legacy, that's how you build generational wealth.
I like that concept. What can you do for those folk who want to get involved in this cannabis field? Is there workshops, meetings, or how do they begin this?
Yes, absolutely. And I'm so happy that we were transferred from the Department of Health to the to OPCA, who was the Alcohol Beverage Regulatory, which is now Alcohol Beverage Cannabis. They have training sessions. If you just go to their website, they have everything. They will walk you through the process. They will tell you what you can do and what you can't do, as well as the Disadvantaged Small Local Business Department of DC. They've been doing workshops and everything on how to get your certification. And
what agency is that? What agency is doing this?
DSLBD. So yeah. D is a dog, S is in Sam. Sam, L is in Linda, B is in boy, D is a dog.
That's a whole lot of D's and B's.
DSLBD. Yes. And of course, you know, I mean, my time is really limited, but if anyone wants to reach out to me, just email me at hello@anacostiorganics.com. I'm a communicator. I do respond.
Hmm.
You said hello@anacostiorganics.com.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, you heard it, audience.
Okay.
And I encourage people, to come by and support a Black-owned business.
There you go.
Yes, yes.
Support a Black-owned business.
Important.
And as a listener caller said, that there's several professions or jobs you can get connected to this field.
Yes.
And folk, if you got a criminal record, you're a returning citizen, the opportunity is there. Some of you have been in prison for possession of a weed and a few joints.
You know, here's what started me on this real quick?
What?
One of my first employees was a returning citizen, and he had spent 30-some years in prison.
Wow.
He had been clean for 20 some years and he applied and I hired him. He had been working for me for over a month and I got an FBI call that I had to fire him immediately.
Wow.
That's what opened my eyes And the reality is he has spent his life since prison out here keeping people out of prison.
Yes.
Right.
And that opened my eyes, and that's what put me on this mission.
Okay. Thank you. Wow. Thank you. Well, we are sure glad you're on the mission, lady. And we appreciate you, Linda Mercado Green.
Yes.
If you want to give a closing comment or web, again, the number our folks can reach you for further information. We want to appreciate you for your pioneering, groundbreaking activities. Lady, you are something else. You want to give us a closing remarks before we get out of here? Please.
I just like to thank you all for this opportunity. I will avail myself as much as possible. And just pray for me. Just keep lifting me up and praying for a successful career here.
Well, we'll pray for you and tell it to the hat, Linda.
Merry Christmas.
Yes, I'm blessed. Yes. Waking up, thanking God. Every day is feeling just like Sunday. Wifey fly by my side. Green light, everything is going good.
From WPFW News in Washington, I'm Sue Goodwin. Today is Tuesday, May 7th. Here are some headlines. Israeli tanks took control of the vital Rafah border crossing between Gaza and Egypt, pushing into the southern Gaza town after a night of airstrikes. A Gaza border official said the travel and flow of aid into Gaza has stopped completely as a result of Israel's operation. The United Nations confirmed today that Israeli authorities have denied the UN access to the main entry point for humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip. Even before the latest escalation in the seven-month-old conflict, the UN has repeatedly accused Israel of restricting aid access despite warnings of famine in the region. UN agencies said they had pre-stocked some aid within Rafah, but said there were very low supplies of water and high-energy nutrition supplies needed to treat malnourished children. The assault on Rafah comes just one day after Hamas announced it accepted a ceasefire proposal following weeks of talks with Qatar and Egypt. Israel, however, said the deal did not meet its core demands, but that Israel would send a delegation to meet with negotiators in Cairo today to try to reach an agreement. An Egyptian former official said a Hamas delegation will also arrive in Cairo today to advance the negotiations. In domestic news, testimony in Donald Trump's hush money trial has resumed in Manhattan criminal court today, with Stormy Daniels taking the stand. Trump faces 34 counts of falsifying business records to conceal his reimbursement of his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, for a hush money payment before the 2016 election to Daniels, who alleged she had a sexual encounter with Trump. Trump has pleaded not guilty to the charges and denied the affair. Yesterday, the court heard testimony from Trump Organization accountants about Trump's payments to Cohen, who facilitated the $130,000 deal to silence Stormy Daniels. Jurors heard for the first time how and why Michael Cohen's reimbursement for the payment was entered as a legal expense. And pro-Palestine protesters on the MIT campus quickly retook an encampment after police cleared it yesterday, ignoring a deadline to leave or face suspension. Protesters easily knocked down fencing that had been erected around the encampment. They are demanding an end to MIT's research ties to the Israeli Ministry of Defense. Police cleared an encampment at the University of Chicago early this morning, where hundreds of protesters had occupied a main area known as the Quad for at least 8 days. A group of faculty held a press conference to defend the encampment as a peaceful protest that should be allowed to continue. Here's philosophy professor Anton Ford.
We support the protesters' central demands that the university divest its endowment and that it suspend its formal cooperation with Israeli institutions. We don't want them getting beat up just because they're camping on the lawn.
At the Rhode Island School of Design, students occupied a building, and a school spokesperson said,